I really do enjoy teaching on presuppositions, because a lot of times when I find myself making a decision, I will say, now, wait a minute, if I'm having trouble with this decision, perhaps it's because I have not really properly evaluated what's involved in making this decision. So they're really the most foundational choices. You have to understand what your presuppositions are to understand what your view of reality is, what your view of life is. And until that's the case, it's hard for you to be consistent and logical and all of those good things in your choices. So the basic assumptions about reality is where I'd like to begin, because there's three primary areas that everyone has presumptions about. And the first one is, what is the nature of God, or is there a God? And if someone is a law unto themselves, they have already made that choice that they are their own God and that there isn't a God that's going to be dealing with them. They don't have that sense. It obviously is a great effect on your conscience. You can just see how that presupposition, what is it you suppose? What is your assumption about God? That's really what a presupposition is. It's your assumption. What is your assumption about God? Do you see him as, yes, well, there was obviously a creator. This is too complicated for evolution to explain it. It's statistically like a 727 just popping up one morning in 30 seconds on the runway. I mean, I've seen the statistics of the likelihood, you know, the probability of a human being ever having come into existence. So a lot of people will say, well, yeah, there's a creator, but, you know, he sort of set the clock and he left, or he doesn't really care, or it was just, you know, it was just a hobby of the moment or whatever, but he's not involved now. But as Christians, we have a God that is intimately involved with us. One that our assumptions is that we are made in his image, that we reflect attributes of God. And the things that he wants us to be are reflections of who he is. And then the second thing is, what is the nature of truth? And this is the one that I would really, really like a graduate course on from Paul or whoever the Lord dictated. Because I always thought it was amazing to me that one of the only quotes of unbelievers in the Bible is Pilate, what is truth? And the fact that he even asked that question showed that he was dealing with an understanding that it really made a difference what truth was. But of course, at that time in history, there was not even the answer to us. We were led into, you know, in the New Testament, when we found that truth is a person. And again, we have almost a circular effect of the terms, how they reinforce one another, because Jesus is the Logos, Jesus is the Word is the truth. You know, all these terms work together. And if we need to get into their flow, and I use the word flow advisedly, because truth is not stagnant. Because of God's progressive, continually, you know, we are not in a strict, we're not under the law in the sense of just a fixed point situation. Because life is always emanating out of God, and we are always growing, and we're always having new circumstances and things work out from that. And it's not that truth changes as truth, but it's our ability to perceive it and to function in it that changes. So it really is a very, I'm trying to think of some of the words all I can think of is, I can't remember the mood it was, but it's now and you better wake up or you'll miss it, because everything is changing. It's always changing in a positive, unfolding way. So the nature of truth is not stagnant. It's eternal and it's stagnant in that sense. But in the human sense of how we are able to interact with it, it's a very vibrant, alive concept. And what is the nature of man? Now, this is the one that, for the godless society, is where we have the biggest difference, because the nature of man, is it inherently good or is it inherently fallen? And so much of what we do is saying it's inherently good, but the only way that our culture is able to enforce that is to make somebody else the blame.
Right.
But then that somebody else that's the blame would also say, hey, I'm inherently good. And so the responsibility, it never settles anywhere. No one wants to take responsibility. And the nature of man is, it is fallen. He's not just marred by circumstances or in need of redemption, but we're really in need of transformation. Now, I didn't get to sit, I looked at Catherine's outline, but I didn't get to sit through it. So that is the transformation part comes in when we're talking about the nature of man, that we are fallen, but the primary thing is we are made in God's image. That is what is most important. Not that we're fallen, but that we are made in His image. And if we assume that we're made in His image, that means that we can uncover, promote, and grow those attributes that He's put in us. And there are so many possibilities, and that's why there's no two of us alike. That's why we need the body, we need one another, why church is a community sport, it's not an individual. Christianity is not a private relationship with God. That's only an aspect. If we really want a Christian experience, if we really want an experience of Christ, we have to interact with other Christians. We have to have that, and that's where iron sharpens iron. That's what community does. It leads us to appreciate the gifts in other people. It keeps a handle on our pride because we realize what things we lack and what things other people can supply. And it also, I think, mitigates our selfishness because we see other people's needs too. And just as each one of us needs encouragement, we can see the need to encourage others. And that is one thing I would say that the secular community is starting to realize. And there's a lot more of, you know, I remember at first I almost laughed at it, but good job, good job, good job, good job. You know, I got tired of that phrase almost. But then I realized that that was just a millennial way, I guess it was the millennials. It was a millennial way to encourage one another and bring in a sense of community in a lot of situations. And so I started saying good job. I like that. But that is something that I think reflects our Christian heritage more than anything else. Because my favorite scripture is Hebrews, provoke one another to love and good works. Just encourage one another for both love and for good works. Because that's how we express our love, is through what we do. So, now I've already given you the answers on these, but what do people use usually to decide them? And the traditions of their own family and their own culture is the most common way that people establish those kinds of presumptions, because as a child, that's how life is presented to them, with these assumptions. And that's why when you're dealing with other cultures, especially ones that don't really have a Christian heritage, there is monumental reshuffling in the mind between the things that are our presumptions in the United States, at least in suburban culture, I should say that, in rural culture, that other places in the world, like when Dr. Jaley was talking about what a small percentage of humanity has ever lived in any sense of real liberty. And the rest of the world, they're going into a whole, they really do have a born-again experience in a very diverse kind of way, way beyond what most Americans. Most of us would be better off if we had a more intense experience of it and we were more aware of the differences required of us. But we're sort of a soft target instead of a hard one. So the traditions of our family and culture is the first place. But of course, personal experience leads you to believe. My children, because they knew how very, very, you know, God as a father has different personality attributes for different families. And in ours, God would show himself able by providing parking places when we really needed them. And our kids actually really developed their faith in many situations around that when they were little. Because for them, it was, you ask and you get it. Other people don't ask, they don't get it. So there's some, God knows and there is a God. I mean, there are little ways like that that build up a child's experience, but also just, you know, in life, their experiences. And this is where, of course, the environment can actually mar people and hurt and wound them. So then that there is some to that. Experts, and it is interesting to me in our current culture, an expert is somebody that entertains you well. An actor of absolutely no consequence in any understanding or knowledge, but that he is good looking, whatever his opinion is, they'll take it. Or she is attractive, or you really like their music or whatnot. Their opinion counts to you, not because they're really an expert, but they are good at what's important to you. So you take their opinion on everything. And then the last one, which is, I think, what was initially used by the enemy, particularly in the 20th century, was the consolidation of two things. One being what is called empiricism, which is what you receive through your five senses. And that, of course, is frequently used to deceive us by the enemy of our souls, because those are not quite as trustworthy as we may think. Even to the sense of what we think we hear people saying at different times, you know, we misunderstand or we mishear or all those kinds of things come up. But then the other part of the scientific method is reason or logic. And, you know, Dr. Jaley was talking about how logic comes from logos, which comes from the word. But logic itself, disconnected from the word, is not, it all depends on where you start applying that logic, whether or not it's going to bring you to truth. Because if your other presuppositions are in the wrong place, you can make a totally logical decision without ever having any chance of really hitting the truth, because you started, you know, Kansas is that way and Missouri is that way, and you think you're going to Kansas and you make every logical choice, but you got your map turned opposite, you're never going to make it. So reason and logic and empiricism are all things that work in a structured context when you've got that part right. But if that part is saying there is no God, or if that part is turned on itself, it's never going to produce truth and it's never going to be trustworthy. And those are the areas where deceit really works. And it's very interesting to me. This last year, unfortunately, I had a lot to do with a lot of circumstances that have way too much deceit in them. And it is amazing how the deceiver, he just gets a start and he gets his foot there. And then you judge things by all this other that looks, it looks logical. It has some objective things that are validating it. But because the center of it, the starting point, was a deception, it isn't. It just isn't. You can see that in scripts where somebody is an imposter. So because they're an imposter, they're never going to be that person, but they can deceive and manipulate because they have studied the accent and the hand gestures and everything to such a point that they're able to pass themselves off as somebody that they aren't. That, of course, is a fairly blatant example, but I'm sure all of us have had situations where we know deception has been involved, let's put it that way, and a high degree of it. So one of my very favorite of the truisms that my husband has developed, the mind justifies what the heart has chosen. Because that starting locus is usually our heart. And then our mind is very good at using all those other elements to justify what that heart wants and come to that decision. And the thing that I want to try to emphasize today is we are made body, soul, and spirit. Now, when you think about that, why do we have that particular order? Why do we say body, soul, and spirit? Would it not be more accurate to say spirit, soul, and body? Because the spirit is eternal, and the spirit is supposed to be the governor. And most people let the appetites of the body and the desires of the soul have a very, very strong part in their government. But government, to me, is that's the one thing I, now I may not have caught it because I was taking furious notes myself, but the locus of freedom is really the self-government. I know Paul mentioned that a few times. And where does our freedom really start is in our spiritual being, who we really are, because it's our spirit that is most reflective of the essence of being in the image of God. I'm not at all convinced that God is going to look like a man, or Maybe he'll look like a man for our sakes because we're used to perceiving him that way, but that doesn't mean he ever is or was or will be. And our souls, to me, are the place probably of the most... I mean, he had the most fun when he was creating our souls, because that's where he got all the variety of personality and all those kinds of things. And, of course, the physical, just the genetic possibilities, you know, he was presented with. I started to say the man. The genetic possibilities he was presented with and all the possible combinations and everything. He just, I'm sure he has a very good time watching things play out, even if to the extent he is a clockmaker, there are things that he likes watching him play out, but he can always cut in wherever he wants to because he is God. So, but the spirit is actually an inherent attribute of the nature of God in a way that our spirit is really what we want to be, our governor, and not our souls. We've had a situation in a church, and it wasn't that this training was evil or bad as such, but it was developing the soul really at the expense of the spirit, because the church was spending more time wanting the soul to be comfortable and well-developed than the spirit to be healthy and strong. And I think that we see that maybe a little more than is good in our congregations. The Catholic Church has maybe made just a little bit too much place for it, but the Western Church has not had much of a appreciation for the suffering and different things that are inherent also in the Christian experience. They're avoided in ways that are not necessarily healthy for us. Not that you try to suffer, but that when suffering comes into your life, people will see it as a curse, which it isn't. It's just another attribute of what we can experience through our souls and our spirits. So the mind does justify what the heart has chosen. And the heart, I really see, as a bridge between the soul and spirit. Because the heart of the matter, when we say that, it's talking really about our essence. And we know that the body is just sort of like a tool, and we're going to get a new one of those. And so it's a more transitory thing. But we're told that we are saved, body, soul, and spirit. The body is saved by it being totally regenerated or changed or whatever. I am curious to see just what kind of bodies we get. But the soul and the spirit, I think that they are something that we will take into the hereafter with us, and that we can go more prepared or not. Part of that's how we live our life, whether or not we're going to have developed ourselves in our soul and our spirit, or, you know, we can decide if we're going to be in the nursery, if we're going to be preschoolers, kindergartners. A lot of this stuff is the choices that we're making along the way. And I do believe we'll grow eternally. And then another truism I want to put out is that disciples are disciplined learners. And the picture that we've used the last couple of years, I really like because I enjoy art, and that is that each of us is like a block of granite, and we're all supposed to be something under. Let's say we're supposed to be a doe, you know, a beautiful female deer, and that in order to really see who we are, lots of this granite has to be chiseled off and taken away so that the sculptor's true vision of that doe can be seen. And that is the way I'm choosing to look at some of the more painful removal of extraneous pieces, if you know what I mean. A lot of times our growth can be quite uncomfortable. So that's how I'm choosing to use that in my own life. I'm going to now switch to the actual notes, if you want to go to the second page there. And the four questions of philosophical inquiry. The first one, these are all long words, aren't they? Ontological question, what is the nature of reality or existence, and what is the origin of life? The questions of our being. And this is really a whole lot more interesting than it sounds. I have found it a very interesting concept. And part of it is there's an ontological equality between all of us. All of our beings are of equal value because we're all made in the image of God. But there are differences in our beings that do not reflect our value, but reflect who God made us to be. And one of the most basic differences, the one that is usually first noted if you're describing a person, is whether they are male or female. It was the first differentiation that God made. So I always see this as that was the beginning of what was going to make Jan unique, was that I was made to be a female. I was not made a male or an it, nor was I given a choice. There was no obvious thing that way. And there's so many choices that are left to us. But that is one that I truly believe that people would be much better off if they just went with God's choice in the first place. And just for them, just for them. But that the nature and how we see reality is affected by that. And that's the other thing about the ability to be in community. We are able to see things our way, but also start to appreciate the way other people see things. And it makes life just so much more interesting than if we were all clones of each other. And so I like the being questions. To be or not to be, that is the question, right? But I was never a statement of Shakespeare, but I believe that is Shakespeare, isn't it? Yes, it is. Yeah. I only read what I had to in eighth grade. I can't believe it. I know a lot more quotes than that. And I've seen some of the plays. Okay, and I've read a lot of the poetry. Then the epistemological question, what is the nature of truth? And how do we know, and how do we know that we know? Now, this one is a particularly important one because truth is a person. That was the thing that Paul added. Truth is a person, and that was that flexible, mobile, continuing creativity that is an aspect of the good. I choose to see evil as being a very limited, wicked and evil is a very limited thing, but truth and the good and love is a very unlimited thing. I think that in the end, we're going to squeeze the bad guys out. But not as a utopia here. No. I did do my thesis, my senior thesis on community and on utopias. And I tell you, when you actually have to go and look into them, I'm not counting on utopian reality. We just do the best we can within the context we have. Which is, you know, the reason we want to support our culture to have godly values in that, because the greater the liberty, the closer we can come. Yeah. I still remember being amazed leaving Southern California and visiting relatives in Minnesota that not only did not lock their doors, they never put a lock on their front door. And no one ever took the keys out of the car. You know, I mean, and there was just whole aspects of life that were just different because of that. Do you guys have to lock your car in Missouri? Not in your own driveway, anyway. So, but it was different in Monterey, wasn't it? Well, it was different. So there's all these ways. And then the axiological question. And this is one also that this year I've come to really appreciate, and I've did it through one of the books that I believe is SLT, either 100 or 200, because I see it on the shelf when I go into the office, which is Simply Christian, N.T. Wright, and The Place of Beauty, which I think is something, when you look at creativity and all the beauty that was created, and those that he develops that as a way, one of the three foundational things to share in relative to who God is the beauty of it. Not that it is a third of God, but it's a way to show what Christ is by emphasizing the beauty and the value of it. So axiological questions are not, axiological does not mean just beauty and value, but it is where beauty and value comes into being and what priority do we give to it. Now this is something that is interesting, isn't it? Because some people are qualitative and some people are quantitative. And one of the reasons I have a difficulty as I get older, I'm becoming much more qualitatively oriented and much less quantitatively oriented. And so many things, they want it quantified because that is how they know how to deal with things, is by elements of quantity, not quality. And just to be blunt, when we go into fundraising, they say, well, what are your quantifiable goals? Well, you can give lots of quantity things, but what came of your quantity? And that, as you get old, you want to see your fruit. You want the good fruit. Yeah, you want to see three generations of a family. This is what you want to see. You don't want to say 30,000 people came to one meeting and we only had 5,000 seats in the auditorium. That's not something that I'm taking with me, if you know what I mean, in the same sense. So I really like the qualitative aspect. And it, of course, is hard to evaluate, isn't it? It's really hard to evaluate. And so I would say that SES supporters are interested in the qualitative nature, not that they don't want quantitative results also, but the quality and what comes out of it in the long run. Oh, and now we're getting really to the long run, which is the teleological question. Teleology, study of the end. Where is it all going? And this was a major, major difference, as far as the whole difference between East and West. And I would say the Chinese definitely got into the quantitative part. They've always been business. But you go, a lot of those Asian areas, however, have very cyclical religions. They have reincarnation. They don't have an inherent sense of progress or any of the things that come from the Christian worldview. The presupposition we have is that God has an end in mind. Relative to humanity, it is the end of this age and the new heavens and the new earth in wherein dwelleth righteousness. So what we're doing is working towards that goal. And we're making qualitative steps towards that goal. Hopefully we're making some quantitative ones too. We're not just, you know, limiting, but that is the, I'm just hoping mine doesn't do it, because I think I turned it off. Anyway, so the study of the end times. So when we were first saved, that was it. There were the charts. There was, it was really, really clear that the wheat was going first. And people were just, they had to quickly decide. I mean, we had one family in particular decide not to have kids because they just were sure it was next day, sure it was next day. I mean, it was very, very sad. And then circumstances made it so they never could have children. I mean, your teleology can be quite important. And more, I know that. That teleology is from a longer perspective in general, but where you think your history is and where you, what you think God's going to do in your life and where you're going, that affects a lot of what you're doing. And people, a lot of times, that their investment, say, is in a particular church, and then if there's a pastor falls, things like that happen, that is like the end of their Christian history to them, because that was all that they had in mind. And they didn't see that church situation as being something on the road to what was really important to God. And so your teleology really does make a difference. And the longer perspective, which means that you really do believe in an eternity. What happens here affects what happens there. But it's not like a substitute for what's going to be in heaven. And so you really do want to have your presupposition be a very long-range presupposition, so that when you find yourself in hard situations, that's when having these questions, you know, I am valuable no matter what, you know, even if it looks like I'm being treated like trash. There is something beyond this horrendous situation that feels like it's going to kill me. All of these choices really affect how you're able to handle the challenges of life and your ability to extract joy. I just love, again, what Dr. J. Lee was saying about Daniel and his long-haul mentality, that he was grateful for where he was in exile because he knew that God was going to deliver the people from the exile. And to get those perspectives in us is going to allow us to be much more mature. We're not going to be the woman freaking out and blocking the exit row for everybody else in the plane, you know. You have to have, these are grounding things, that I am important. I'm made in the image of God. I can know truth. Jesus will lead me into all truth. Isn't that a wonderful scripture? And that he has put beauty and things of true value in life that I can enjoy and that I can help develop and make available to others. And then the teleological question is, ultimately, God has something for me at the end. That heaven is a wonderful place filled with God's beauty and grace, right? You know that old, it was a Sunday school song, wasn't it? Maybe it still is. So these assumptions are called the presuppositions, and all organized expressions of thought have them.
Our presuppositions set our spiritual agendas for both personal and social life, and they determine how the information is gathered, how it's analyzed, how it's presented, and how the person wants the information used by the reader, observer, or listener. So I just gave you an example from me that I gathered these questions right here off of the sheet of paper that was given me.
This is a copyrighted program of Go Strategic, Santa Rosa, California. Unauthorized reproduction is prohibited. Go Strategic is an international nonprofit organization that educates and equips leaders and others for effective service and leadership using biblical principles. For more information, visit us online at www.gostrategic.org.